So this is our third full day of session, and last full day of session. So by now, you know, we've really settled our energy, and you know, even if you come along a little bit later, then in this kind of hook into the Dharma train, and I don't say that too lightly, because you do actually hook into that kind of a general less activity in our minds and just our general demeanor. So you kind of feed off the power of session. So it's a really good reminder to really be diligent in this last period of practice. And you know, we know what being diligent means. You know, it means applying meticulous effort. So there is effort that's required, and it's not being casual. So it's actually paying attention, raising that energy, noticing when the mind drifts off into thought and ideas and stories, and then just returning to your practice of whatever that is. And you know, this particular practice that we have is been around for a very, very long time. In our school we have kind of maybe four or so particular methods, and so we have counting the breath, following the breath, shikantaza, and koan study, kind of the four main formal practices that we teach and follow, and they all have their own benefits. And there are lots of other forms as well that we could employ, or we do employ, and we've all got our own, you know, self-styled methods for staying awake and aware. And they all change, and they kind of change during the course of a session too. So for instance, in some of the earlier Zen texts, they talk about six kinds of meditation practice, and the first is counting the breath, and that's been around since day dot, I guess, and it's particularly about counting 1 to 10, so I guess they probably counted it in Chinese or Japanese. And then there's following the breath, which is letting go of the counting itself and just paying attention to the rise and fall of the breath. Then there's the practice of quietening the mind. And you know, so that's something that kind of happens when doesn't always happen, but when you really pay attention to breath, the mind starts to lose some of its habitual commentary. And then there's observation of the body, which, you know, we can't help but be aware of. So that's where, you know, you're paying attention to the physical sensations, you know, the tightness, maybe some discomfort, or again just the way the body functions when it's sitting, or when you're walking. And then there's turning the mind towards the mind itself, which is quite interesting, you know, that we pay attention to this thing that is paying attention. And what is that? It's almost like the trying to see yourself or trying to hear yourself. The mind just looking internally, scanning. And then there's probably what we call true, like shikantaza, which is really just the mirror mind. Which is when really relaxing that opening, that broad experience. And you know, our mind is it's very sticky. It's a very sticky thing. And it really is just through an accident of, I don't know if it's an evolutionary thing in terms of Darwinian survival of the fittest thing. Possibly it's got some kind of reasons why this particular strain of so-called humans have survived with this way that the mind works. But we, for better or for worse, it would seem that we have this consciousness that has arisen that is different from tree consciousness and bird consciousness, well, we think, hard to know. Planet consciousness, rock consciousness, universe consciousness. And we have a consciousness that tends to reflect and reify. I like the word reify. Hands up who knows what reify means. Well, kind of means make something solid or concrete. So you reify, you know, it's like it makes it into a solid thing, a real thing, a concept. And so our experience, we tend to form that into fixed things. And that certainly works for us and is part of our living experience, our lived experience. And we call it all kinds of things. We call it dualistic thinking, conceptual thought. It forms all our relationships and so-called duality. And so that's, and our mind is very, very sticky in that sense that things that pass, it's very hard for things to pass through without us checking, conceptualizing, matching, seeing where they rank, and whether they're valuable to us or not valuable, and we get so habituated to doing that we do it 24/7, and like I said, it's neither good nor bad. It's just what we do as beings, as human beings, And most of it's probably pretty good. It's creativity and science and all that. And so it's crazy for us to try and eliminate it, and to try and blank out our minds. Because you're going against kalpas of a conditioning. And it's just you. Versus a large universe. So our practice is not about getting rid of those thoughts, you know, but really about putting it in its rightful place. And the mechanics of our practice are to appreciate those thoughts and ideas and concepts for what they are. You know, and don't, so, you know, we don't need to feel discouraged about thinking, you know, and constant thoughts. But when I say being meticulous, it's about being meticulous about applying our hard won and many generations of discovery and effort that we can apply that method to letting go of our attachment to the thinking, because we really are addicted to it, to thought. Really are. And it kind of quite, and when we're very addicted to activity, and that's quite interesting. All the flurry of devices these days, you know, you can sometimes have a whole group of people sitting around on devices, and it's funny, Sinead, visited Sinead on the weekend, and my kids were talking to Rosa, and Rosa was doing, what, three things at the same time, I think? Our kids are not quite there, but they're almost there. So there's a conversation, I think texting and reading, and it's like that ability. I mean, it's a huge development in human consciousness in some ways to be able to do multiple things at once, but it's also the... although I did see a cartoon again, it was like about it's almost like the nothing much has changed cartoon, showing a family in the 1800s sitting around a tea table, and they're conversing, but they're also all on their devices. Someone's got their paper, someone's doing needlework, someone's, you know, pouring tea. It's that in some ways things haven't really changed, and we just have different ways of doing it. But in terms of that being busy. Is that we have this strong need and almost unstoppable capacity to have our mind engaged, and so when we come to Sesshin. We're encouraged to kind of cut the root of that thinking. And it's really challenging to do, really challenging to do. And yet that's what our practice is. So, and it's quite simple, because Sesshin is, it's set up so that, I talk about this most Sesshins, that everything's kind of taken care for us. So, you know, we're fed, we're provided with soft cushions to sit on, someone's going to ring the bell at 30 minutes as they fall asleep. And then we're going to get up, we're going to walk, and everything is very simple. And so the only thing we really need to worry about is the next moment, or this moment. And so it's almost like telling yourself that it's okay, that we don't really need to plan. Things will take care of themselves at the end of Sesshin. So it's allowing the skill of the Sesshin setup is to create the environment that you can actually, you don't have to worry about that mountain lion who's about to jump on top of you, or whether there's going to be food. Those basic needs are really taken care of. And so when that happens, then you can tell yourself, you can tell your worried thoughts that, okay, you just have to get through the next breath, really. And it can be downright boring, you know, it's just... especially at the beginning of Sesshin, it's like, oh God, there's, you know, 3 or 4 days of not doing much. And yet all you need to take care of is the next breath. And that's your horizon. So when we practice like that, anything that emerges is just the next thing that we pay attention to. And what it means is that we develop over time an ability to, you know, use thought rather than be used by thought. A kind of fluidity of mind. There's a story that my teacher Tenshin Roshi would tell about an old Zen master called Nishiwaki Roshi. And Nishiwaki Roshi was a successor of Harada Shogaku Roshi, who was, if you know your Zen lineage, but he was Arada Roshi was the also teacher of Yasutani Roshi, who was Maizumi Roshi's teacher and also Aiken Roshi's teacher and kind of responsible. So Yasutani Roshi was kind of responsible for a lot of the Zen in the West, the White Plum and the Harada Dan Sangha lineages. And Harada Roshi brought in koan practice into the Soto. He was a Soto Zen priest, but he brought in koan practice. And so he had about four successors. One with Nishiwaki Roshi, and another was a layman called Toan Roshi, who apparently lived in a smelly hut. Peter Matheson describes it as deplorable hut that smelt, a deplorable smelly hut smelt of dried fish and sake, and he was an incorrigible alcoholic, and be covered in his poems and writings, and he said one time Harada Roshi came to visit him, and he was so embarrassed he tried to hide under all his newspapers. But Harada Roshi said he was the most brilliant and enlightened of all his successors. But as Bernie Roshi commented, he said it's like one of those things is that sometimes you can have the most brilliant enlightenment, but if you don't quite have the conditions right, in other words, kind of ethical conditions right, then your teaching may not be accepted widely. Whereas Harada Roshi was someone who had great gifts in all those directions. But anyway, Nishiwaki Roshi was a successor and was a very small Japanese man. And he turned up at ZCLA in the height of the 60s, you know, and so all the people were showing he was, you know, Harada Roshi's heir, and everyone's Nishiwaki Roshi. And so they're showing him around all the memorabilia at ZCLA, and you know, there'd be the really important Zen stuff. And Nishiwaki Roshi just like, oh, look at this Roshi. This is like, you know, the Heart Sutra from original piece of cloth from Dogen Zenji's temple. Like, hi. So everything they would show him, he just go, I look at it, oh, hi. Hi. And then finally they had this big party, and it's like a Zen Center party, and that's as you do, and there's Nishiwaki Roshi sitting on the side, and a large American woman, who they'd all be large to him because he was very short. Roshi, come and dance. But he's in the middle of this drunken Malay, you know, there's people booking around, and Nishiwaki Roshi just, hey. And this tension said it just to demonstrate that mind that is not sticky, you know, not concerned with formality or you know, just responding to things as they arise. And I guess that's one of the benefits of practice that we you know, we appreciate the variety of life, and then hopefully we shine a light on our own conceptions and conditions and the places that we kind of stuck and judge, and that's through that very basic practice of paying attention to what's in front of us, and then when the thoughts and ideas come up, seeing them, letting them go, and then just coming back to this direct experience. I thought I'd just read a koan here. This is from the Book of Serenity. And so the Book of Serenity is 100 koans that were compiled 8th century, I think. Read the intro. Anyway, the 100 koans in our tradition, they have an introduction, the main case, which is a koan, and then a commentary as well, and a poem. at the end, and also commentaries on the poem. So they're quite in depth, and that this book here and the Blue Cliff Record are both 100 koans each, are a wonderful collection from that are used in our in the White Plum and other koan traditions. And this one's case 3 from the Book of Serenity, or Shoyuroku, and it's called The Invitation of the Ancestor to Eastern India. So the koan is, a Raja of an East Indian country invited the 27th Buddhist ancestor, Prajnatara, or Hanyatara, to a feast. The ancestor, the Raja asked him, why don't you read scriptures? The ancestor said, in other words, why don't you read to the assembly? The ancestor said, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of the body or mind when breathing in, and doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. I always reiterate such a scripture, hundreds, thousands, millions of scrolls. So this is about Prajnatara or Hanyatara, and he was the teacher of Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma came from India to China around about the 5th century. And so Bodhidharma was the first Zen ancestor, really, and in China. And then so Hanyatara is his teacher. And the story of Hanyatara, again, this is kind of another one's one of these mythical Indian ones. So the description on this is that the 27th ancestor was first called Kayura as a boy. As it came to pass that the 26th ancestor, who's Punyamitra, was riding by in a chariot together with a king of eastern India who is known as the Resolute. The ancestor asked the boy, this is the one who would be Hanyatara, so Punyamitra asked Hanyatara, can you remember the things of the past? The boy Kayura replied, I remember that eons ago I lived in the same place as you, Master. You were expounding the Mahaprajna great wisdom, and I was upholding the most profound sutra. I have been awaiting you here to assist you in the true teaching. Punyamitra said to the Raja, this is not one of the lesser holy ones. This is a bodily reflection of Mahasathamprapta, the one who has arrived at great power. The Raja had the boy get into the chariot, took him to the palace and made offerings to him. When the boy put on monastic robes and had his head shaved, the ancestor drew on the connection of the Prajna or wisdom scripture to have him called Prajnatara, a jewel of wisdom. So that's kind of the story of Prajnatara, how he came to be the ancestor. So he takes up that case that so the king or the Raja, the local Raja, invites him to a feast. And the Raja asks him, so why didn't you read scriptures? And you know, Prajnatara says, this poor wayfarer doesn't dwell in the realms of the body or mind when breathing in, and doesn't get involved in myriad circumstances when breathing out. And I always express the sutra, hundreds, thousands, and millions of scrolls. This is a very Zen koan. And so you know, you've got the party going on, and there's a big feast going on, and there are all the worthies there, and you've got Prajnatara, who's the local priest, and normally the priest would be expected to give a discourse and read from the sutras, so the Raja asks him that question, so why don't you? And he gives that response. Basically breathing in and breathing out, I recite hundreds and thousands of millions of sutras. It's kind of, you know, in some ways it's quite an easy koan to get, you know, it's, you know, but it's, when we look at our need to have our experience verified by someone else or something else, that's kind of one of the points of this koan, that in someone else's words or someone else's expression, someone else's explanation, someone else's approval even, and that's kind of quite strong within us, checking our appreciation of life with someone else's. You know, and having young kids, they'll be constantly asking or checking for approval, at least at the age, nice age now where they are, they very soon won't. I'll be checking theirs for theirs. But that, where it's like, am I doing this right, Dad? It's like that kind of thing. And when I'm conscious, I sometimes make the decision of whether to say yes or no, or just to leave them to it. And that leaving them to it is really a, you know, it's a wonderful practice, as long as it's not just neglect or laziness, which is often is, I might say, to my chagrin. And pass that off as a teaching. But my teacher Tenshi would also say that the struggle is a really important part of practice, especially when you see people at the Zen Center really going through pain and whether struggling with personal issues or with a koan or something that was happening in the community or something external, and just that. But that struggle was really, really important to, as he said, to build strength. And it's not so much strength as in like, now I can fight demons. But more that strength and that ability to rely on yourself and your own experience. And working out your own way. That's why I said at the beginning, there's like, there might be, you know, 6, 10, 4, whatever kinds of practice that we do, that really is a, you know, there's only one thing that you do, and it's your own personal way. You know, your own kind of set of questions. And it's interesting, I talk with Tenshi probably once every couple of months, and there's always, and it's interesting to track different things that come up. He never said this before. There's something like, you know, now I'm telling people to really study their own angst. And I say, oh, that's quite a strong word, isn't it? Angst. But you know, again, that's the angst or anxiety is really, really personal. It's like, what is the thing that's your kind of edge? And what is it that that we struggle with? And that's the, you know, the Buddha's first teaching is that you know, the truth of suffering. The truth of angst, or the truth of that we all kind of have an edge, and it's all really personal. It's not a casual kind of question, and that's the thing that brings us to practice. And I think that's really important to study, because that edge of practice is what brings it home. You know, this isn't a practice about scriptures, about studying someone else's words. you know, the practices as pranayatara is just like that breathing in and breathing out, that my direct experience of my life is the thousands and millions and hundreds of sutras. And this is where Zazen, if you read Dogen Zenji's writings, he's always in praise of Zazen. It's an amazing, amazing tool. But the thing is, it's not just a tool, you know, it's actually a full expression of your practice. You know, we sit here for a number of days and basically you're kind of pinned by force of conditioning, I guess, in group kind of togetherness, you know, to this cushion and into Riversleigh. And you really become deeply intimate with your own experience, whether it's thoughts or physical sensations or the sounds outside. And you can't, you know, move away from this this bright mirror in your life directly reflecting back from you. You know, we try, you know, we'll kind of dodge around it. But every time we look up, there it is again. So we really, you know, we deeply experience our lives. And it's pretty challenging too to show up and have our lives shown to us. You know, it's like it plays out on that screen. It's almost like we do all have these projector screens or mirrors in front of us. And that's why it's a movie of your own life for the next 4 days. Yeah. And we try and dress it up. And we try and become the main character or the villain. You know, and our practice really is just to kind of remove those clothes and just experience it directly. And so that's pranayatara, is, you know, breathing in and breathing out, just letting those scrolls of your life and others just flow. And not adding to this, you know, this illuminated life that we have, totally illuminated. So we've got one more day, one more full day. Tomorrow's we'll do a commemoration of Bodhi Day, and then we have the precept ceremony for Kelvin at around about 10:30 tomorrow after work period, and today we just mentioned Barbara Yoka Fletcher, who is Tenshin Roshi's mother, who died about a month ago, and just wanted to honour her commitment to the Dharma. Not many mums who take the precepts. He's an old Manchester Mancunian. It was a great support to attention and the centre of myself for many years. So just appreciating her commitment in life. Yeah, so one day. Yeah, just take care of this life. And thank you.